Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chander Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And this episode is with Melissa Bruntland. And I've already interviewed her husband on this podcast, Chris Bruntland, who works for the Dutch Cycling Embassy. But a lot of the content that you'll see coming through their accounts, and I'm sure lots of you follow this, also follow them, will have been produced and shot by Melissa. So she's a writer, advocate, and all-around amazing storyteller about cities and urbanism and how to make these better places to live in, move around, play in, and just hang out in, really. And what I really wanted to talk to her about was the book that she's written, Women Changing Cities. She wrote it along with Chris, but I think this is Melissa's thing. And it's really all about these amazing stories of cities that have had women leadership, either in positions of political power like the mayor, or people who have noticed something in their city that they think they need to do something about. Often that's around sort of safety and mobility. And it really shows that when leadership happens with empathy, care, and collaboration, which is more common, or at least very prevalent when you have women leaders in these cities that need to change, I think there's a really important lesson in that. So we talk about Paris, Montreal, Manila, Delhi, Tirana, Sydney, and some others that I'm sure I'm forgetting now that I'm recording this intro. But they are all amazing stories of how female leadership has brought and big change, often sometimes against the odds. So I also really appreciate Melissa has this lovely way of creating the narrative, which isn't all around sort of finger wagging and very much more around like, how do we get things done? Which ultimately we all want to make these places better places to live, work and play for everybody. So I think this is a great conversation about humility, care as infrastructure, and why cities might look a bit better if we stop pretending that progress has to look heroic. So without further ado, here is a conversation with the wonderful Melissa Bruntler all about women changing cities.
I mean, it depends. At this point, I mean, how many? I think I've only done 3 or 4 this month. I mean, some months it's like once a week, and other, well, I mean, actually, we're meeting up with John Zimmerman for Active Towns tomorrow. So this week is a busy one.
Just a 3 or 4.
Just a 3 or 4. Some months there's none, but other times, yeah, it's like interviews, or actually, I have 2 things tomorrow because I also have a call with someone from the New York Times. But it's because the book just came out.
Yes, this is all because you have a book.
Yeah.
And I've had the pleasure of speaking to Chris twice. And in both of those interviews, he's bringing up you because you kind of work as a team. So I want the brains behind the operation.
Appreciate it.
Your name is first on the book. So, Melissa, I'd love to get this started by having you introduce yourself rather than me messing it up and confusing you and Chris's intertwined lives.
Sounds good. Melissa Bruntland. I would call myself an urban mobility expert, but starting out as an advocate. I've been working in the field of sustainable mobility for 15 years now, starting out, like I said, as an advocate and then working my way into a more advisory role. And my role in this space, I see as someone who is a storyteller and a content creator, helping people understand all the amazing work that's happening in cities around the world to make, yeah, not just mobility, but just public spaces better. And I do that, yeah, through writing, photography, video, presenting, all sorts of things. But really, at the end of the day, it's about telling a good story. And that's where I find myself.
And you're phenomenally good at it. So I saw you on stage talking about this a few weeks ago. And I kind of want to anchor this around the book. But living in Montreal, I think it's interesting because there's a whole chapter on that. And then there's also a Montreal municipal election coming up where the lady that you celebrate a lot in the book is a controversial figure.
She is.
I think there's a really interesting theme in your book of, we'll go back to it, but like, I think there's a really interesting thing in there of women who've transformed cities, and some of them are like poster children. Paris is like the obvious one that people go to a lot. Mm-hmm. But then like Bogota, Manila, Kampala might be a little bit more under the radar. But a thing that really struck me is like, one of my big takeaways from reading it is this isn't about picking a fight. This is about solving a problem and getting something done, even if it's in a sort of imperfect manner and like working with it. But maybe I've jumped ahead way too much and asked like 7 different things or like sparked 7 different things in that topic. I think the whole thing that you've sort of written about, you know, speaking about around women changing cities, massive. Can we maybe go all the way back to the beginning of like, why did you write it? what prompted you, and then like we'll talk about stories within it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the idea for Women Changing Cities probably started several years ago when I started working with an organization called Women Mobilize Women, which is, it's this umbrella, under this umbrella of the Transformative Urban Mobility Initiative that is funded by GIZ, which is then getting its money from the German Development Bank. It's a very complicated way of describing it. But this Women Mobilize Women started in 2018 as a way to create a network and an organization that can support women working in transportation, largely in the global south, but globally as a whole. How do we create this environment where women know that they're not alone and we can create those training and mentorship opportunities? And I came into the organization around 2022, support their communication stuff, but also helping them with setting up webinars and networking events and things like that. And through that opportunity, I met a number of really remarkable women, part of a whole series called Remarkable Women in Transport, who are working around the world to do exactly what you kind of mentioned, this idea of just transforming cities. And through these conversations and through the people I got to meet, I felt this like desire to tell the bigger story about what's happening. I mean, having been in mobility now for 15 years, I've been in countless rooms where I'm the only woman in the room, and I've had
it's a blokey world.
It is seriously blokey. And I've heard so many times, "Well, Melissa, there just aren't a lot of women that are doing this," and I'm like, "Yeah, but there are. We're just not giving them the space." And so, yeah, I think that's sort of where it all kind of started, is like, how can I shine a light on these people even more so we know what's happening around the world, so women like me know that we're not alone, and especially younger women know that there's this whole network that they can turn to for support as they build their own careers. And for Women Changing Cities, it was this thing where I said to Chris, I'd really like to write this book. And he wasn't opposed per se, but his interests have always been more on the wonky side of, I mean, he would love to write a bike about bikes and trains, and who says that book isn't going to happen one day, but that's where his brain was. So he's like, if there's a way that we can come together, maybe, but we'll see. And then we received an email almost 2 years ago now from REBA, the Royal Institute of British Architects, from one of their editors saying, if you ever want to write another book, let us know. We'd be interested in producing something with incorporating your photography as well. And yeah, that was kind of when I knew, yeah, we're going to write a book. And then the way I kind of pitched to Chris that we could sort of tie in this desire that I wanted to do is that there are so many cities that we've been watching from prior to moving to the Netherlands, but post moving to the Netherlands, and especially during COVID, where we were seeing this, like these major transformations, like Paris, like you mentioned, like Montreal. And the common denominator often was that women were in the lead. And so this was the story of like, okay, we can capture these moments in time of these cities, capture them in photography, but also tell the larger story of, you know, why it is that when women are in charge, shit gets done.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's like the thing that I love about the book is you tell it through the stories of real places. Like so many of these things can get quite theoretical about this is the process or these are the principles, whereas you've kind of done it much more of this is Paris, this is Tirana, this is Kampala, this is Manila, this is Montreal. And there's talk of like how it got done. But mm-hmm. I feel like you've anchored it much more about like cities are not the same. Like no two cities are really the same, but they also share a lot of common principles.
Yeah.
But I love it's like you can pick this up and like flick through one chapter and be like, there's lots of different things I can be inspired by. How would we do something similar in my own city?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was sort of the core thing I wanted to try to make sure carried through throughout the narrative. And part of what I had learned through the work with Women Mobilize Women as well is that every city is dealing with very unique challenges. Every country, you know, if it's India versus Indonesia versus Colombia, they're all dealing with different sort of challenges in terms of the transport sector and how to make it more equitable and gender responsive. But there's so many similarities and we can all learn from each other. I mean, that was sort of the lessons out of the first book with Chris in terms of building the cycling city, was there's all these Dutch cities that have for 50, 60 years now been enjoying cycling utopia, for lack of a better way of saying it. But now we're seeing in the last 15, 20 years, more and more cities outside of the Netherlands applying some of these ideas in their own context to solve similar challenges, but in a different part of the world.
It's that sort of perfect retort to, but we're not Amsterdam, but we're not Copenhagen. But it's like, cool, like no one's asking you to be, but like this is how you go and apply some of it to there. And I think that the, even if you just take the Francophone thing of like Montreal's not Paris and Paris is not Montreal, but you can kind of put Anne Hidalgo and Valerie Plante together and be like, same, same. But there's also a lot of things when you dig into it different, like they're such different people.
Yeah.
With totally different backgrounds, thinking a different way, even at different ages and different life stages.
Exactly.
I think that's like a really important takeaway from like, you look at some of the individuals that are referenced in this. And I'm picking the two, they're probably the bigger names or maybe the names that are most known to me, but there's people in there who are really like uncelebrated individuals who get their moment, I think.
Yeah. Well, and most recently we just, part of the book promotion was to share a little bit of a snippet out of the story from Manila of Keisha Mayuga, who, you know, for her, she was just a young woman who listened to another woman on a bus once about how this woman didn't get to see her son often enough because she had to leave 2 hours before her job started and it took her 2 hours to get home. And it just for her was her own personal story with her and her mom. And just to be able to share like this for all those people that say that young people can't do anything, or the young people that feel quite despondent because they feel like the world is changing in a way that they don't want it to. There are people like Keisha and like the group that she's a part of and has helped to keep supporting in Manila to make change, even if it's small to start, it can become something. And it's the same with Amanda out of Kampala. She's just another young person that studied in Apeldoorn in the Netherlands and then took those ideas back to Kampala and said, no, I know that we're not Amsterdam or we're not Apeldoorn or Utrecht or any of those cities, but we doesn't mean that there aren't people here that also want to be able to cycle, and I'm going to fight and fight and fight to make it happen.
There's a really interesting thing of when you get more of the female perspective, you end up coming back to this idea of care. Mm-hmm. And I think if you go to the transportation, people who like bikes and trains or people who work in sort of transit environments, often the men in them, they don't necessarily have the lived experience of being a carer. And yeah. I think that's a thing that you were talking about this on stage in Vancouver as well. And I think it comes through in the book of there's something around like care and mobility, which is two things that I think often get treated as completely separate buckets. And I think there's something about like women changing cities where like female leadership recognizes the care. It's not always the women providing care in a situation, but it leans that way. But then it's like how do they get around and how do you connect them between, they might be like they are working the care industry, but it might then also be like that 2 hours they've got to go to get back to their family. I think there's something in that where those dots don't get joined up traditionally with the way that the industry's organized itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if you look at the way most cities calculate mode share and the types of like the and the way people travel, it's looking at the trips to work. I mean, that was the thing in Canada. If you look at the census, when they're counting who goes by bike, by foot, by public transport or car, it's always the trip to work. The trip to work is one trip that only a portion of our population actually does. And all of the other trips, like it's, I mean, we always come back to, I think as parents, we tend to lean on this idea of taking the kids to school, but even just going to buy groceries for yourself, for your household, or dropping off dry cleaning. These are all trips that, I mean, most people don't dry clean anymore. So maybe take that. Some people do. I still do once in a while. But just like those types of trips that just have to happen so that we can function, that we don't take into account often in transport sectors in terms of how do we make sure that public transportation is not just fast and efficient to get from home to work, or cycling networks aren't focused on these long distance trips that can happen as fast as possible. And it's often one of our big complaints. If people ask us, you know, how could Vancouver, for example, the place where we started as advocates, be better? It's like, well, the problem has always been that it never connects to the places where people need to go for these everyday trips. For us, it was, we always had to walk to the local grocery store after we sold our car because we couldn't cycle there safely. Yeah. Or if we were taking the kids to the dance studio on Commercial Drive, again, we had to go along a bikeway and then leave the bikeway to get them there and take the kids on arguably an unsafe environment for them just to access dance class. That's the thing, is if we're only focused on getting people to and from work as fast as possible, we forget all the other things in between. And that's where this like mobility of care or valuing care work is really something that the cities that take it seriously are the ones that are having the fastest impact on how people can move.
I always think a really interesting one is the like connecting the hospital without having to drive. And it's like I was thinking about this in Toronto last year, broken shoulder. The natural thing was saying, and you can still drive with one arm, but like the natural thing was you go to this hospital and you drive there. And I was sort of watching people in and around the hospital of like, actually, how do you get here if you're not driving?
Mm-hmm.
And they're spending quite a lot of money on taxis, or they're having to get friends and family to drive them there. And then if you, I think the UK is actually broadly kind of good at this, but like some of the busiest bus routes in cities will be the ones that go to the hospital. And yeah, there'll be a bus to the hospital every like 5 or 6 minutes. But like, and the nurses are using it, and the patients are using it, and the visitors are using it. And I think that's the sort of, this popped up again in another Canadian context of an organization that operates public transit in Canada, whose name I shall not mention, but it won't be terribly difficult to work out. They talked about, they couldn't understand like all these different reasons that people would ride their trains. Mm. And all their sort of personas that they'd done, they were very proud of the personas, but they're all based around mostly men going to a meeting or going or commuting to work or something like that. And there was very little of like people going and doing something for fun, going to the cinema or going to visit a sick relative or anything like that. Not that that's fun, but you know, not work examples. But like, I think that that's such an important part of it. And then you read it, the way that you've written about it in this, it's like, you're not telling people off, which a lot of like urbanism books kind of do. They kind of wag a finger at people. And I think it's like a really, and even the way that you talk about the women in the stories, they're sort of, they're telling their story versus and solving a problem versus having an argument. I think there's something really important to that.
And that's, I mean, that's always been the approach, is to try to be as positive as possible. Or I mean, it's positive, but like constructively critical sometimes. But I think, like you said, there are so many books or social media accounts or YouTube channels that are busy telling people how they're doing it wrong and how it needs to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And those are valuable, and we need those voices. But then we also need somebody to say, but these are the good things that are happening, regardless of if you agree with how it's been done or not. It's still had this positive impact. And for us, that's, I think, what's been most important, but also most rewarding for us, is that we can, despite how we might feel about a city, we can still find the good in it. Yeah. And I think that's, I don't know, what we try to, as I think has come across, that we try to do in our books, is just at least tell these positive stories that, you know, you might not agree with everything that they've done in these cities, but you can still see the value in the long run of what's been done.
No, I really appreciate it, because I can be a curmudgeonly cynic and the sort of guy going, this is wrong, why are we doing it like this? And I appreciate there's people that are a bit more gentle in how they go about driving sort of change. But on that, I started this book when I rambled around like Montreal. Montreal's had 8 years of a female mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only lived there for a year, but I've been going to Montreal for 10 years, and Montreal is a better urban environment after 8 years of Valerie Plante than it was previously. Now, there's lots of things that are imperfect and don't really work very well. And there's wonderful artwork all around Montreal of like traffic cones. It's become like the symbol of the city almost, of like construction projects that just drag on forever. But it's popped up in there's an election in a couple of days after we record this. I've already voted. But a lot of people are sort of looking at it and going, she's bad, we don't like her, thank God she's going. But when you ask them about, but is Montreal a better city, they kind of go, yeah, but thank God we're not going to have her any longer. And I think there's something really interesting about, I don't know if it's a common thing or if I'm just thinking as a few examples of it, but like female leaders typically go, you know what, I've done my thing, I've done my bit, I've not made it perfect, but I've made my changes, time for me to step away and go do something else.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to that that not many people talk about. But I guess my question is, how do you look at this, of these great stories of positive things, but there's still backlash? How do you work through that so that hopefully these legacies don't get washed away?
That's the million-dollar question, really. And I think, I mean, you touched on it, this theme of understanding that I just need to get this stuff done. And, you know when it's time to step down. We saw that. We've seen that with Valerie Plante. We were also seeing it with Anne Hidalgo. When we spoke with Elke van den Brandt out of Brussels, that we spoke to her just before an election year as well. And we started to worry that we were having a negative impact on women in leadership. Thankfully, she won quite a lot. But I think she put it the best in that I've been selected to do a job. I'm going to do that job. Some people are not going to like it. I'm not going to do it perfectly. There's going to be parts where I get it wrong. Nobody's perfect, and we can all learn as we go. But if I don't get reelected, at least I know I've done what I was supposed to do in that time. And I think that's, for a lot of the women, that was sort of what we kept hearing, is that it's important to just do the right thing. And people get elected into these positions, or they get selected for roles, because of the work that they say they want to do or the qualifications that they have. And understanding or having that humility that, you know, maybe it's not going to work out, I think helps to spur these people to do the best that they can in the time that they have. And we have this funny anecdote, and they will also remain nameless, and the city will remain nameless as well, so that it doesn't narrow it down. But we did, I mean, we recognize that a lot of the work, like the work of Valerie Plant, like the work of Anne Hidalgo, of Elke van den Brand, of Anwar Aristani in Tirana, all of them, is built on the foundation that somebody else started. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they just came up with these ideas out of the air and said, I'm going to change Paris, or I'm going to change Montreal, because nobody else has yet. But we did talk to one of these people, a man, to find out a little bit of the foundation of the story that was being realized in the moment that we were telling it or recording it anyway. And the whole conversation centered around how he did all of this work and it's his project and me, she's ruining everything, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, whoa, what just happened? Mm-hmm. And it was a funny moment for Chris because he's like, I've never sat in a conversation like that before where I realized like the difference, the stark difference between the conversations with women were around we, our team, we all did this collectively, or, you know, the organization did this as a whole versus me, I, power, all of these kinds of things. And the resentment he had because he didn't maintain that power. It's so fascinating. And I think it's partly why that humility or that humbleness to know that maybe I'm not going to get it right and maybe I won't stick around, but while I'm here, I'm going to do it, I think has been what has been transformational for the cities that we were able to visit and many more that we haven't been able to record. And I think that's one thing I want to say is, you know, we've captured 11 cities or organizations in a moment in time, mm-hmm. but it's not an exhaustive list. There are so many, and, you know, we're happy to have been able to visit the ones that we have. But yeah, it's like the cities that are, again, the people that are thinking about this collectively. And we were talking before we started recording about visiting Ghent, and that's another city where collectively they're working forward. And there, the mobility minister is a man, and I've met him. He's a wonderful person, has that empathy and that understanding that this is the right thing to do. That is helping Ghent change for the better. I've rambled, but that's sort of...
You hit the empathy word. So I think there's like an interesting thing of, again, I'll go back to Montreal because it's very topical just now. But I suspect the person that will win in the election and has talked about rolling a few things back that Valerie Plante has done, mm-hmm. female. Valerie Plante's successor for her political party, male.
Yeah.
And if you read interviews with him, like Valerie Plante's like story is an interesting one. And I've heard different sides of the coin, and I'm not sure necessarily what is entirely true. But like broadly, she wasn't really trying to become mayor of Montreal. Her successor in Projet Montreal says, I don't really want to be mayor, but someone had to kind of take this on. And I think there's something really interesting in that of humility, and like there's a lack of ego kicking mm-hmm. around it. And then you also use the empathy word of it's listening to people, putting yourself in other people's shoes, seeing the world from a different perspective. Women tend to be better at that than men, but it doesn't mean it's always women doing it. And it doesn't mean that all women do it well.
No, exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, like, I suspect the one who will win in Montreal, I think all the her beat, like the people I know that really want her to win are men. It's like, it's often around like we kind of, she's been a politician at various levels, and she might be a great politician. I don't know. I didn't vote for her.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean she'll be bad. I actually think I think it was AOC was talking about this, of like, you cannot vote for me, but I'm still representing you. Mm-hmm. And I think there's that kind of, there's a discourse in politics that's so important there, but it comes from lack of ego and empathy.
Yeah.
Which just, we don't have enough of it.
No, and it's funny. I mean, you're talking about how Montreal has their election coming up next week. I just came off of yesterday an election here in the Netherlands. And it's the same thing. It's, you know, I follow Dutch politics as much as I can. Yeah. As newly formed Dutch person, but I don't read through everything. But they have these handy like voting suggestions or voting surveys you can take to figure out where you kind of land. And the questions, as you're going through them, you're like, well, yeah, of course I think that no matter where you come from, you should have access to healthcare, or that students should have this, or we should take care of the environment. And all of the questions that I pick are all based on this idea of empathy. I have an empathy for, like, this is not just my planet, it's other people's planet. It will be our kids and their children and so on and so forth, legacy. And so what I do now, I have to have an understanding that I might not benefit, but somebody else will. And of course, then I land on the very, very left side of things, very progressive in terms of this whole idea of being empathetic. And then on the flip side, the very conservative are like, you know, very, it's all about ego and I want to be in charge and, you know, we need to be making money and, you know, very, I don't know, very unempathetic ways of thinking about the world. And I will see how things go here. It sounds like we've landed somewhere in the center, and thankfully I live in a place where there are so many parties that the coalition will have to will likely include some more progressive ideas. But yeah, it's such a different message, but it really is like the ones that are not thinking about care, are not thinking about empathy, are not looking beyond their own sphere of benefit. You know, they're the ones that are not really moving cities forward in a way that benefits the most of us. They're moving cities in different ways or countries in different ways, but it's for the people that already have the most without thinking about the people who have the least.
There's something really interesting when you don't really use the progressive word too much. You talk about moving things forward, which I think it shows that you're a storyteller, because especially over the last sort of 8-10 years, progressive as a word has become tarnished in the political spectrum. But there's like a thing of a lot of the values and a lot of the things that people who might lean and end up further right on that survey you took, actually, a lot of the time they're talking about community and they're talking about like quite traditional values. But if you look at what a lot of the quote unquote progressive people are talking about, they're trying to do things that create community and traditional values.
Yeah.
It's actually like some of you just really like driving a car. But at the same time, you still want to know your neighbors and you still want, like, you want to cut down on crime and you want people to be, like, nicer to their neighbors and whatnot. Like, I think, I don't know, I find that really interesting because you're touching on it and I can see there's words you use and I suspect those words were very carefully thought through. But, like, I think that's the really important thing. I'm struggling with this in cities where you end up having an argument with somebody and it's like, we kind of want the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, I mean, the greatest frustration I have when I'm listening to quote unquote conservatives, you know, whether they're progressive or not, but it's just this idea that, you know, I just want, you know, to have my comfortable space where I live and I want my neighborhood to be crime free and I want it to be beautiful and all of these things. And I'm like, yeah, we're talking about the same thing. I mean, I'm talking about, yeah, making more space for cycling and walking and sitting. And you're talking about making sure that you have a place for your car. But then when you get out of that car, that place is great for walking and cycling and sitting. It's all the same. It's just that we've become so polarized, stupidly, in my opinion, over things that, like, we're all working towards the same values. It's just, yeah. And I think that is one thing, like, in when I'm working professionally and I've had colleagues where we've worked together, and we've talked more about what are the values that you want. We don't talk about, do you want more people on bikes? We talk about what is the quality of the experience you want to have when you go outside or when you go into your city center. And, you know, in the conversations that I have where you have this backlash, like you were referring to in Montreal or in other places with the other women that we got to profile, at the end of the day, if we can get people to talk more about what they want and what they value, then it becomes a little less political most times. And it becomes more about, like, we just want nicer things. And whoever's in charge, whatever, the point is that what we do on the ground is to make our places happier places to be.
I'm kind of hoping, and when I do the write-up of this, you let me use a couple of pictures, but, like, I'm just picking the Kampala thing where, like, there's this picture, which looks like a quintessential African city of loads of people, some cars. Like, it looks fun, but it doesn't necessarily, as a visitor, but it doesn't necessarily look super livable.
Yeah.
And then you have this picture of, like, admittedly, there's a lot less people on this street and it's not like an apples to apples comparison. But, like, you look at that and go, that's how something that works in Europe could be applied to something that might be in Africa.
Yeah.
And admittedly, that African street has sort of 60s concrete buildings that were sort of the remnants of, like, this is how you build colonial cities.
Yeah.
But I think there's something really interesting in that of seeing it side by side of, it's not do Ugandans want bicycles? It's actually, do you want a nicer place to go shop, to go have lunch, to go work, to go for a walk or whatever? And broadly, there are some principles that make better places for that. And it doesn't need to be like a thou shalt create Dutch cycling streets to get you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's funny because you showed that example. And I unfortunately, we didn't get to travel to Kampala for this book, distance, time, whatever. And we worked with a wonderful photographer who took those photos for us. So we're really grateful for that. But I did get the chance to go to Delhi in the beginning of September. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's like there's obviously some remnants of the colonial history there in some neighborhoods that I'm like, this feels like this was built by white people for sure. but what fascinated me is that the place that was most vibrant and there were the most people is in Chandni Chowk, which is the old spice market, where they, for years now, they've kept motorized traffic out. So all that comes in are electric vehicles, or I shouldn't say all, there's exceptions and people breaking the rules, but mostly it's India. But mostly it's like, it's rickshaws and it's people walking and it's people cycling. And it's just filled with tourists, obviously, because it's the old spice area, but also locals that are there to visit the mosque or to go to temple, or, you know, it's just this wonderful, vibrant place. And it doesn't look North American or Western European to me. And there's trees in places. And it's, you know, it's that same idea. It's the same value. We just want the central place to come and enjoy life beyond the automobile or beyond a vehicle and just feel connected. It can be Chandni Chowk in Delhi, or it can be Delft City Center, or it can be Montreal and the open streets in the summer, less so in the winter because it's too cold, but whatever.
I can debate you on that, but I want to keep to Delhi for now.
Yeah,
I didn't bring up Delhi so far.
But I mean, yeah, all that being said, I love Montreal and I love it in the winter as well. So take my comment with a grain of salt.
I will do. But like I think the Delhi thing it's kind of hard to get your head around a city of 34 million people.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been to Delhi. I've been to Mumbai and I've been to Calcutta a couple of times, but like Delhi's still on my list. But like, I think the story there starts with something like genuinely abhorrent and shocking of like an assault on a woman on a bus.
Yeah.
And I always find that there's those cities that kind of have this is the women's only carriage, where to me, like, it's kind of like you see it in the West of companies will say, often transit companies will say, we do not tolerate abuse of our staff. But as soon as you see that thing, it's almost a symbol of this is not a quality place to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's something like you see and it's again, I talked about this in Vancouver, but like more interestingly, less wrong, like the women's only carriages on a train is like, that is the best current solution to some of the problems that are being faced. But in an ideal world, it shouldn't be like that. Or I don't think it could be like that. I think that India is always the example that sort of like turns the volume up to 11 of like, it's an assault on the senses. It's sort of like a lot of forgiveness, like begging for forgiveness rather than asking for permission. There's chaos. It's not something you can perfectly order. And somebody's probably listening to this going, "Ian, you're totally stereotyping Indians." But like, but I think like it's such a good example of you kind of start. I think that's the first one in the book, if I remember rightly. Maybe I'm wrong. Second,
no, it's not the first. It's not Barcelona's the first chapter, but that's okay.
Whatever. Yeah. It's early in the book.
Yeah.
But like, I think it's like it's quite a sort of assault on the senses, starting the story from an assault on a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That I think kind of goes to you're not doing the lovely, cuddly utopia of, isn't it nice that Paris is like a cycling city now? Anyway, I think there's something there where it's like I find it quite a hard one to ask you the question about because I don't really know where to start with it, but it's like there's lots of different ways that this plays through and it's not a perfect solution, but like it sort of gives you hope of if it can be this bad and we can start doing something about it, then we can get to really good places. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. We wrote that chapter before I had a chance to travel to Delhi. Chris had been prior to us being able to write the chapter, but the woman that we profile, Kalpana Viswanath, is a wonderful human being who challenges me on the regular. As I said, when we presented in Vancouver at Rural City, but she's the one that will say, okay, Melissa, your European ideas are great, but in Delhi, they don't work the same. But she has a lot of love for Delhi. And she actually, when I organized an event together with Women Mobilized, she was one of the women we highlighted. And she referred to the stories that we tell about our cities as love letters to our cities. And she feels that the work she does is a love letter to Delhi because that's where she's grown up. And her work again, like you said, it's imperfect. It's not necessarily solving the very big challenges that a city like Delhi with so many people has in terms of ensuring safety for women in transport. But she's come up with a way to try to address that. And at first, like when I first heard about the Safety Pin app, I'm like, okay, great. We are creating this app of crowdsourced data so that men and women, but mainly women, can know this is an area where at night I probably won't feel as safe based on the results of what other people have said versus taking a different route, maybe going a longer way, which are active choices that women around the world are making all the time, is which is the route that I'm going to take home, which is the mobility choice that I'm going to choose to make sure that I'm as safe as I possibly can be from the moment I leave where I am to when I get home or vice versa. But it's more than that. This app is about, like, it's about that. But what they've been able to do at Safety Pin is take that data and package it in a way where they can present it to the governments to say, these are the ways that we can help address this quickly and more long-term policy changes so that we can help more women. So that, yeah, hopefully eventually in Delhi or in Mexico City or places like that, they don't have to have women-only carriages, that there's enough knowledge, enforcement, proactive enforcement, so that women feel they don't, it's not just about the aftercare, but it's knowing that if I get on this train, I will be safe on my way home, which I think is, yeah, I mean, it's a step and it's an important step, but it's often like that's the gap with a lot of advocacy to government change is, you know, as much as I don't like to rely on data, I would prefer that just the qualitative experiences of people is enough to reinforce change. This data at least helps to convince the policymakers there that this is something they need to act on.
I was on the metro, the underground or the subway, whatever they call it in Cairo, a couple of years ago. And there are a bunch of like kind of teenage girls in like the normal carriage. And there was a guy sort of telling them off of like they should be in the women only carriage. And they were sort of like going back to him and be like, no, like we don't want to be confined to that. So I thought that was actually like a really good, like, and they were probably doing because it's safety in numbers, but I thought it, yeah. It was like the middle of the day. I just thought it was like a really interesting interaction of breaking down the like by having the women only carriage, you create a bit of a barrier, but they were sort of breaking the barrier of being like, no, like this is all like that help, that is a safety net for us, but ultimately that's not what we want to be confined to. And maybe that's like a sign of these things kind of working.
Yeah. Well, and this is the interesting thing. And we can have a whole episode on debating the women only carriages and buses and things like that. But it is this like, okay, it's, if you're traveling as a woman on your own, you'll probably choose the women only carriage. I did when I was in Delhi and I used the metro, but what if you're traveling with your partner and like in a man-woman relationship? You know, what if you're traveling together? Or what if you're traveling with your teenage son and he's not going to be able to come into the carriage with you, even if he is 14, but he's like my 16-year-old is several centimeters taller than you, you know, like suddenly there become these limitations. And to that, I mean, to one credit, at least the women-only carriages are open for people with disabilities or from physical to neurodivergence and also visual impairment of all genders. So at least they have this place to be. And I did see a gentleman with a visual impairment being aided onto the train, and then someone was there to meet him on the other side to help him. So they do have those systems in place. But then, yeah, like I said, there's all these caveats that suddenly the women-only carriage doesn't work. Like if I'm traveling with Chris in India, I'm not going to travel in a different carriage from him. That's dumb.
Yeah. It's interesting that, like, again, being in India with like Katrina, my wife, and like it's funny when she gets unnerved by it, but she also finds it really interesting when like you get the stares of like everybody looking at you because she's got brightly coloured hair and she's in India and whatnot. But I can imagine that like if you're by yourself, that'd be super, like it goes from being sort of like an interesting curiosity to something that can be quite threatening.
Yeah,
bridging those, like how you make that work and how it progresses over time, I think is very interesting. But that could be a whole new episode.
Yeah,
I just want to go back a bit because I don't think we pushed this enough. But like, you've not profiled just politicians, so I think there's like the more I've done in this space over the past couple of years, there's a lot of people looking at me like going, but what can I do? And I think there's a bit of a movement towards sort of people who don't necessarily think that they have a voice doing their little bit. And it might be like suggesting some ideas. It might be doing like a very small scale thing. You touched on some of that earlier, but I think I just want to come back to like that. How do people get started in this? Like what are the things that you've learned from speaking to these women of how you start making your own little dent in the universe without necessarily having to be a politician. And in some cases, those people do become politicians, but yeah, I'd love to get your take on that.
Yeah. I get this question a lot, particularly because I didn't study transport planning or urban planning. I studied fashion design, for those that haven't heard that before. And I find myself now in my mid-40s being a transport professional.
Somebody has to make transit sexy and fashionable, so thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. But yeah, I sort of reflect on my own journey, and it was, you know, all of us develop these interests and things. Some of us go a little bit deeper. And for those that are interested in changing their cities but don't want to learn how the cookie is made, don't do it. Because once you know, you can't stop. It kind of ruins cities sometimes when you're traveling around. But anyway, for me, it was just I have this interest. I started meeting other people that had similar interests, and I sort of dove into this community of advocacy. And I often tell people that's a place to start. If you're not interested in going to school and getting a degree or a master's in this, but you still want to have an impact, it really is finding your tribe, for lack of a better way of saying it. And then, you know, it could be one person. For me, it was one person on the school ground where my kids were going to school. And then they're like, well, have you checked out this? And then suddenly you go to an event, and then your network grows and grows and grows. And you can start finding the people that are doing the change on the ground, that are doing street art or tactical urbanism projects, or other people that want to make really beautiful films and photography about how wonderful a city can be if we all just slow down a little bit. You know, in that way, you can start having whatever impact it is that you want to have. But yeah, it's having some patience. It's knowing that it's the key thing is knowing that whatever you're doing, it doesn't mean that you're going to change the city overnight. It's going to take time. And, you know, Chris and I often say, you know, we're planting seeds now that for trees that we'll never be able to enjoy the shade of. But that's, you know, that's the reality of trying to change behavior and change cities. It takes time. But if you can find the people that are all working towards the same thing, then sometimes, you know, magic can happen.
But if you haven't acknowledged that that's the reality, I think you can get burnt. You can get very frustrated and very burnt out very, very mm-hmm. quickly in this realm. I like in the conclusion how you talk about sort of building alliances, and you just literally just were just talking about that.
Yeah.
But I think that that's such an important part of it, where it's I think there's this sort of growing movement of stop having arguments, which I'm not learning again very well, but like solve problems. But that's back to the sort of like the I'm not from this urban planning background. I don't have the sort of the natural career path, but it makes you a more powerful force effectively in a way, because you see the world in a different way. And because you're good at telling a story, you can do something. But then mm-hmm. there might be some sort of technical skill that you just don't have and couldn't possibly know. But because you've exactly. made a friend somewhere, you get to bring that in.
Yeah.
There's like a really interesting thing of, I think, maybe this is a super generalization, but like female leaders are probably better at, to your point when the guy saying that there was that guy sort of going, this was all my idea, blah, blah, blah. Female leaders are a bit better at being like, you know what? I know I did that. Other people are getting the benefit of it. I'd rather people didn't want to steal the credit and like claim my work as their own, but women are a bit better at sort of, sometimes you just got to let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been in that boat on numerous occasions where, you know, well, there'll be, you know, an award that goes out for someone's like long-term advocacy in this space. And I'm like, how come I never get picked for that? I shouldn't say never. And this is not me begging someone to now pick me, but it's sort of, it is like, I have that moment, but then I'm also like, yeah, but I like what I do. And mm-hmm. if I'm having an impact, and if I have one person that tells me at an event that, you know, the work that I've been able to do has helped inspire them to also start doing that work, then, you know, great. That's, I don't need a trophy on my shelf to tell me that I did a good job. It's, you know, I know that what I'm doing is the right thing. And, you know, if I get rewarded, great. And if not, it's not going to stop me from doing what I need to do.
An old boss of mine said, like, you need people who are really good at, like, sort of, they're positive arsonists, where like, they start fires, fan flames, and then get out of the way and let other people, like, sort of take it on.
Yeah.
And I've always appreciated that, of like, there's sort of the, some people just get more sort of satisfaction and pleasure from somebody else like going and taking something on and getting success from it. So I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
I thought the Tirana example is really interesting, because I think that the current mayor of Tirana is actually still the mayor, but he's in prison.
That's correct.
Yeah, a previous guest offered to introduce me to him. I was like, oh, I don't know. Can he do podcast interviews from prison?
I don't know.
Is he the right person to have on this thing? But like, you actually end up seeing Edi Rama as the president of Albania, taking a lot of prime, I don't know what quite what his title is, but like, also huge man, like he's like 6'7" or 6'8" or some giant guy. Very funny if you like Google Eddie Rama and Maloney from Italy, and he always like kneels at her feet to try to sort of bring himself down to her level, which I think is hilarious. But like a lot of what's happening in Tirana, like he's kind of taking credit for, and he was the mayor at one point, so like okay, fair enough. But like I think there's something interesting of Tirana does go a bit under the radar, but until, and I've been there, but until I read your book, I was like, I wouldn't have thought of this as a woman changing a city. So like that's I guess there's something really nice to that. There's something that's maybe like, it's a shame you have to like, it's not a shame, but people should buy your book, but it's a sort of shame that like she's not more known for what she's done.
Yeah, well, and that's, I mean, Anuela Rassani, who is the deputy mayor for mobility, and to be fair is probably doing a lot of the leadership role at the local level at the moment because of the current situation. You know, I didn't know about her either until, again, this work with Women Mobilize Women. And the bike mayor there, Iden Pedraj, actually works at the municipality and is advising on mobility, but people don't know that of her. They know she's the cycling mayor and she does cycling education courses. But she's like, for a while, she had the ear of Arian, the mayor who's currently in prison, to like help advise him on how to make mobility more equitable and more inclusive and how to build cycling out. And, you know, to be able to share those stories, I think is really nice. But I mean, aside from their social media feeds, they're both also not the type of people that are like, look at all this amazing work that I've done in the time that I've been here. But it's more, look at how the work that we've been able to do as the city of Tirana has benefited children or has benefited the cycling community and those kinds of things. And I think that's, at the end of the day, that's the message that most cities should be telling, because I think that helps take it away from this idea that the person in charge is like all ruling and will change everything, to rather, you know, this is how the community is benefiting from the work that is done by the collective that is the public entity. As
And this, ultimately, the whole cycling thing, I think, is a good one to pick on, where it's a mayor can take a lot of credit for cycling, like Bain. Like they, because they create the air cover effectively to say we're going to build a lot of bike lanes, but there's tens or hundreds of people behind the scenes who actually have to design and build the bike lanes.
Yeah,
and I think that gets a bit lost sometimes, rather than like, yes, you can get started by going cones, paint, job done, then a bunch of cyclists turn up and you go, I need to do a bit more now. Like, what's this going to look like? And I think Montreal is a very good example of, there's lots of bike lanes that are a bit shit, and there's lots of bike lanes that are really good. And now it's like, hopefully the slightly shit ones that are better than not having a bike lane get improved, being the next stage up. But like, that's not necessarily a mayor. That's, or like even sort of like the lead for the transport portfolio. There's actually a lot of sort of technical people that like cycling, understand the principles of it. They have to design and build it and like make it a real thing. And it becomes a lot more serious as you start committing more funds to it. So
yeah,
I think that's really important to address.
Yeah, well, and this reminds me actually of when we watched you present at World City, and I was like, shit, is he going to talk about all the cities that we visited?
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. You had no idea. But it was funny because, you know, you were talking about Paris and how wonderful it is, and you said, but Melissa says it's a bit shit to cycle in, and of course now this is recorded. It's not shit to cycle in. It is wonderful to cycle in compared to what it was 10 years ago, but it is still very fast and furious for a lot of people. So Paris has a way to go. But exactly to your point, it was sort of, we need to solve this problem of transport access now. We already have a lot of people on bikes. We need to give them more space. So let's just put it wherever we can during COVID and, you know, make sure that people have safe space to move by bike. And then you see that expand. And now you have Rue de Rivoli, which is giant in terms of cycling around. But that took time to get there. It took, you know, understanding how the quick build invited people to that space, but then the technicians behind the scenes saying, okay, it's not working in XYZ ways. It's not quite safe in terms of reducing conflicts between pedestrians and cyclists. How can we now change this while making sure the whole traffic system doesn't shut down? Which we know, for those of us working in cycling, when you take space and give it to bikes, it doesn't mean that the whole network is going to suddenly grind to a halt. That needs to happen over time. Same in Montreal, same in Vancouver, countless cities. So it starts out a bit shit and then it gets better.
I think the UK is a really good example of that. Of like, if you take secondary British cities, there's a lot of terrible bike lanes. They're just a bit of pain, and they sort of start up for like 50 yards and then disappear and then spit you out into traffic. And like, no wonder nobody bikes around here, because that's crap. I think Paris has like probably done it really well, but like what Paris has done is like you said, it's amazing, not perfect, quite scary. I imagine as a novice cyclist, it's bloody terrifying. So I'm kind of excited to go experience that in a couple of weeks, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because Chris and I were talking about this. We just had to go through Paris to come back from Turin in Italy. And he's like, it's good in Paris, Melissa. It's not that bad. I'm like, yeah, I know, but it could be better. And he's like, yeah, it's really not that bad compared to what it used to be. I'm like, yeah, I know. It can always be better. And my job is to tell them to get better.
This is the curse of advocates and innovators, where it's you can become a bit of an Eeyore of even when things have got better, you're often going, how do I make this better? Rather than sort of pausing and celebrating. And you're a lot better at this than I am. But sort of going like, right, actually, we've done this way more interestingly, less wrong, not perfect. How do we keep doing it? So I think there's an important lesson in that. We could go on and on, but like we've gone on for a while. I guess I've got two questions. One is a complete cop-out question from an interviewer, which is, what have I not asked you about in your book that I really should have asked you about? And maybe you use it as an opportunity to be like, oh, I'm not going to give you the full answer because people should buy my book, of which link will be provided in the comments.
Yeah, a question you haven't asked me that I think we need to talk about. Now I'm trying to think. Oh, gosh.
We haven't talked about Brussels very much as a city, and we haven't talked about Sydney at all.
No, actually, yeah, that's a really good... I had this question actually come up in an interview I did last week about Sydney and asking about Lord Mayor Clovermore. And I'm not going to get into the story because you should buy the book, which the link will be provided in the comments. But what's really interesting about her is that she is like the definition of someone who said, I don't want the big power. I want the impact. Mm-hmm. Because she was working at the state level, also at the local level. And it was because of her opposition in parliament that she ended up saying, no, fine, I'll just focus on Sydney. I don't need to be at the state. I don't need to be at the national level. I want to have the impact in the city. And I follow her on LinkedIn. And just yesterday, she was sharing a story about how during COVID, as the city allowed businesses, particularly restaurants, to expand their patios, like most places, to make sure people could still get outside and enjoy public space. And they, because of COVID rules, if I understood correctly, and forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, people from Sydney, but you had to sit down to make sure that you were all physically distancing properly. And what has happened is the latest story from the opposition is that Lord Mayor Clovermore is trying to stop people from just standing and enjoying a beer in public space. And how dare she? She wants us all to sit down. And she's like, what is going on? I'm going to go to the bar right now and have a beer to get over whatever I've just read. And I'm going to stand while drinking it. And it's just funny because she's still facing this ridiculous opposition, but she's, you know, in all of that, she has a sense of humor. She understands that, you know, she's doing what's best for the people of Sydney where she can. She's trying to have a positive impact. And, you know, for all the stories of the mayors that haven't been able to continue on, she just keeps getting reelected. So she's clearly doing something right. But I find her story fascinating. And that's part of it is like we captured, like I said, this moment in time of the work that she has been able to do with several other people, other women that we profile in Sydney. But she's to keep following her story and keep seeing how she's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do what's right. And if you don't like it, whatever. We'll see if I get reelected again. And I find that fascinating.
There's a really interesting thing in our times of a lot of politics is kind of not... The Labour Party in the UK would have called it the Ming Vase strategy of don't say anything controversial, don't upset anybody, try and be inclusive.
Yeah.
And ends up being like nobody's happy. And there's a sort of thing that's like, fuck it. I think a lot of people want this. I kind of want this. There's some data and some research that supports it. Let's give it a try and see what happens. And throughout that, there'll be some really noisy people who will be like horrible individuals. And then 3-4 years later, they vote for you again. And it's almost I'm not going to worry about what these really loud people say. I'm just going to worry about doing the thing that I think works. Mm-hmm. And like, it's the best re-election strategy.
It seems that way in a lot of ways. I mean, it's true for Mayor Anne Hidalgo. It's true for Valerie Plante. It's true for Elke Vandenbrandt. It's true for Anwar Al-Rustani. It's true for Lord Mayor Clovermore. Like all of these women who could continue to run are like, you know what? This is just, I just got to do this. And if I don't get reelected, okay. And then people are like, oh, I actually really like what you did. Check.
Come back.
So I think that's, as you said, it's just this, it's a good strategy to make sure that, you know, maybe you're going to piss some people off, but there are a lot of people that maybe don't tell you that what you're doing is actually making their lives hugely better and they'd like you to keep doing it.
Yeah. So on that note, magic wand question. So
okay.
I always do the forget about regulation, forget about reasonableness, forget about sort of logic. You had a magic wand, you can apply it to a city, some cities, politicians, anything you want. What would you do with a magic wand?
It's a tricky one. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, push come to shove. I think for me, it's just, it comes back down to this idea of making cities fun. And it, for me, it's, my kids are grown. So whatever fun means to them, it is what it is. But it's, I think that we, magic wand would be to make cities fun for kids. And then they become fun for us as well in a lot of ways. And so, you know, it's putting playgrounds and splash parks and lots of trees and rocks to climb on and spaces for people to ride bikes or walk or, yeah, that to me is, you know, magic wand, that's what I would want. I would want cities that are greener and more fun to play in.
I love that. Like, you know, we never talk about fun and play in cities, and it's like, I don't know, we always get down to sort of logic and reason and sort of sensible stuff. But I think, like, you live in the Netherlands. One of my, and this is a disclaimer, this is not something you should go and do, but I really, one of my most fun things to do in cities is have pints and ride a bike around Amsterdam. One probably shouldn't do that, and the Dutch probably don't like it when English and Canadian people turn up and have too many beers and ride a bicycle, but it's fun because you can't do that sort of thing in other places, and it makes, like, it makes everything you do there joyful, and it probably sells extra beers.
Little things, like, I find myself doing it. I'll be cycling along, and if there's nobody around me, which doesn't always happen in the Netherlands, there's a lot of us on bikes. But if I happen to have a slight decline, that does happen sometimes, I do what I used to do in Vancouver, which is I just zigzag along the road, which is just fun. It just makes me happy. Or if I'm walking and there's like a bunch of leaves, I've been doing it since I was very small, but I will just kick the leaves. And I actually get mad when people rake up all the leaves and push them on the or throw them in the green bin or whatever. So I want to kick the dry leaves. And wouldn't it be just great if anyone that wanted to be able to do that can without feeling like they're inconveniencing everybody else?
I know lots of people in their mid-30s to early 40s who want to do that like they're 6 years old. So yes, all for that. And that is the best note we can end this thing on.
Amazing.
Melissa, thank you so much. It's been a joy.
No, thank you. No, it's been fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Just once again, thank you so much for listening to this conversation. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. And we'll be back very, very soon with more episodes of the Challenger Cities podcast. Thank you very much.